2004, District Superintendent Frank Tassone was arrested and charged with embezzling millions of dollars from his Long Island public school system. Now, I am no expert in white-collar crime in America, but I am an expert in watching basically everything on HBO, which includes the 2019 film Bad Education, based on this case and starring Hugh Jackman as Tassone. The performances are stunning and the story engaging, but the uncomfortable thing about this movie for me wasn't the crime that was committed, although, of course, stealing is bad. It was the lies that had to be told about the lies in order to not be caught in a lie. The discomfort I feel from these kinds of stories differs from the discomfort I feel watching, say, torture scenes. Although, of course, boys and girls, torture is bad. What's different is that I've never once tied someone to a chair and broken their fingers. But I have most certainly lied. Now, of course, lying is bad. It's also something that academics like Dan Ariely from Duke University happen to study. In a lecture I watched, Ariely said of lying, "It's not about being bad. It's about being human." At the very end of Bad Education, there's a scene where Jackman's character finally fesses up to how it all started. "It started," he said, "with two Greek salads and a couple fountain drinks. I fucked up. I used the wrong card by accident." He planned to settle up on Monday when he returned to the office, but nobody noticed or even cared, really. And so he didn't. And that's how it started. Ariely's research about dishonesty shows that the brain reacts very strongly to a first act of lying, but then it adjusts. The subsequent lying registers less and less. That adjustment is disturbing to me. I honestly don't know what to make of all this, but I do know we all lie. Sometimes it's noble. We lie to protect someone else. Sometimes it's selfish. We lie to get what we want. Sometimes it's ego. We lie to make ourselves look good. My guest today has his own story of dishonesty and other people's money. And he, too, never intended to do what he did over the course of a few years. And it started with something so small. Small enough to make me fidget in my chair. I'm Nadia Boltzweber, and you've stepped into the confessional. It's like a car wash for our shame and secrets. For listeners joining me for the first time, stay tuned for after the interview when I have a blessing that I've written just for my guest and maybe also just for you. Hey, confessional listeners, I just want to thank you for supporting this podcast. And I wanted you to know that there's a place called The Corners where I regularly engage with readers, post essays and prayers and bonus content from this podcast. It's called The Corners because it can feel as though some of us have been relegated to the edge of every space we are in. But here's the thing, I love The Corner. I always have. It's where I always choose to sit. Because from there, you can see the whole room. And because I love the other people who hang out there. I love outcasts and queers and the girls who talk too loud. Because I love the kind of humor that comes out of lives that have not been easy. Because I love sober drunks and single dads and sex workers and the guy who lost a leg in the war. Because these are my people. And you can join us and engage with me and my work at nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. Join other folks who share my love of grace, snark, confession, mercy, pop culture, and of course, God. We'll see you there. Joining me in the confessional today is Casey Anderson. Casey, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what brings you into the confessional today?
So in 2009, I moved to Germany. I was a working musician at the time, and I moved to Germany to go on tour and then was dating a woman who lived there, who had moved there for work, and so decided to stay.
How old were you?
I was 30.
Okay.
Yeah. as I was 30 years old, and I was at the time in recovery from alcohol and cocaine use.
For how long?
I had been a few years at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was part of a group of people working on a benefit compilation album for the West Memphis Three. So the West Memphis Three, for those who don't know, were three people from West Memphis, Arkansas, who as children were convicted of a murder that they didn't commit. Two were sentenced to life in prison. One was sentenced to death. And so their case became kind of a cause célèbre among people in the art communities. And there were several benefit concerts and albums on their behalf. And we were coming up on the 10th anniversary of the last time a benefit compilation had been done. And so I talked to a man named Danny Bland, who had been behind that first benefit compilation and who was a friend of mine, about doing kind of a 10th anniversary thing. They were still incarcerated at the time. Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. were the names of the three then young men. And I just said, you know, I want to try and revisit this, do a 10th anniversary of this benefit compilation. Let's give the money to the Legal Defense Fund. And he was, of course, very excited about it.
There are a lot of people who have been wrongfully convicted out there. So why specifically did the music community start to pay attention to this one particular case?
Largely it was because they got convicted based on the evidence that they wore black t-shirts and listened to Metallica. But I think a lot of people gravitated to their story because they were young and because they really stuck out in their community and had been alienated prior to this, before being accused of the crime.
So it was like one of the satanic panic type things.
It was totally one of the satanic panic things. And so Danny and Lori Davis, who is Damien Eccles' wife, and myself had a conference call and sort of came up with a dream list of artists. And it was my job to make sure that we had enough money to cover the costs of those artists.
Okay. Yeah.
We managed to raise quite a bit of money, and I, you know, was deposited into a business bank account. And that was kind of it in terms of my discussions with Danny and Lori about the thing. They got kind of busy and it just kind of hung, and I kept kind of accruing this money from people based on claims that I was making about artists that we hoped to have involved in the thing.
Okay, say more about that.
So, you know, I would present our dream list to these people, but I would present it in such a way that it was like already, it had already been done. You know, so instead of saying...
So you lied.
Yeah, I would lie.
Okay, fair enough.
So I would, you know, instead of saying we hope to get Tom Petty, I would just say we're going to have Tom Petty. So we raised a significant amount of money. And then I was still living in Germany, traveling a little bit in Europe on tour. I was not sleeping a lot. And I would stay up for like weeks at a time. And I would go through these periods where I would be convinced that certain things were happening in my life, and then weeks would pass and I would like find an email or be told by the person I was seeing at the time that these things had not happened. So an example of that is like, I truly believe that we had gotten Bruce Springsteen to commit to this benefit compilation. And so when I went to present that to the group, I went back through my emails and there was no such communication.
How do you explain that?
I have bipolar disorder. So I didn't know that at the time, but that's like delusions are part of mania. But I'm also able to just kind of navigate through them and lie to people and not think too much of them and just kind of keep moving forward. I also relapsed on alcohol and cocaine and had kept that a secret from my partner and from anyone else who knew me. So I was still telling people that I was in recovery. And that I did very pointedly because I felt like a lot of the relationships that I had in the music industry were dependent on like part of my identity being in recovery. I had made a lot of friends.
Being in the sober club.
Right. And I'm not going to tell my girlfriend because I feel like she would be upset at me. And I'm not going to tell my sober friends because they would be upset. And I'm not going to tell my family because I'm in another country and they're back in Portland. And I don't want to feel a phone call from my mother every day for the next several months.
No one does.
No one does.
All right. So you're in Europe. You're alone a lot. You're managing the money for this benefit album. And then you relapse. So then what happens?
So I was like, well, I'm in Europe and I'm traveling. I'm on tour. I was on tour with this band, the Low Anthem. And musicians are very used to shitty, like, La Quinta hotel rooms. And I thought, I'll stay in the Sofitel in Munich. It's really nice. It has a spa in it. I'll just try that. And so I thought, well, they're going to put a hold on the card when I show up, and I don't want to have like my personal funds frozen while I wait for the hold to come off and pay for the room. So I'll just use the card that's attached to this bank account.
Mm.
And I did it. And then I thought, you know, when the tour's over and I am, you know, I'm like, I'm reconciling my bills, I'll just pay back into the bank account for my personal fund.
So really it was just for convenience sake, I'm just going to do this. And you weren't thinking, I'm going to take money out of this account and keep it. You really thought, I'm going to pay it back.
Yeah. I mean, like has been a really hard thing for me to explain to people throughout my life when this few years of my life comes up. And this, like, I also don't want this to sound like an excuse, because there were any number of times where I could have stopped spending this money or told someone what I was doing or gotten some kind of help or, you know, made it right to these people. And I didn't take those opportunities. But it's not like I thought, well, I'm going to make up a fake benefit compilation album. I'm going to take a bunch of money from these suckers and then I'm going to spend it on hotel rooms and whatever else I can get my hands on.
So you're buying all of this stuff all over Europe with the money that mostly friends of yours gave for a legal defense fund for the West Memphis Three.
Yes.
Okay, so keep telling me the story. So what happened? You're doing this. Nobody's noticing.
Nope, nobody was noticing because no one was looking at the account besides me. So I'm spending this money and I'm seeing that it's dwindling, and I'm starting to consider that at some point we're going to need to either fund this benefit album, or if it doesn't come to fruition, if we can't make it work for some reason, then the people who contributed are going to want to see their money back. So I just kind of started coming up with projects that didn't really exist and asking people to invest and promising them like a kind of wild return on their investment. I was at the point where I believed that Bruce Springsteen and Lady Gaga were going to do a duet. And I had emailed the people in the little investor group saying as much, like, this, oh, okay, it's locked in. Springsteen and Gaga are going to do a duet. And they were like, oh, wow, that's incredible. Let's see the contract. And so then I'm confronted with like, oh, I don't have this contract. So then I just forged, like, I knew who managed Springsteen. I knew who managed Gaga. I know what a contract looks like. So I just forged one and sent it off and was like, there you go. It's locked in.
Oh, wow. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like a nightmare, literally. Like, if I have an anxiety dream, I could imagine it being exactly what you're describing. Like, I didn't mean to steal some money, but it ends up I did, and I can't really remember how I spent it. And then I'm convinced that Lady Gaga and Bruce Springsteen are doing a duet. Do you know what I mean? And then people are like,
yeah, yeah,
show me proof. And then in the dream, I realize, oh my God, I didn't really book them. And now I have to, that's what it feels like, your story.
Yeah. And now that I'm years removed from it, and I am a person who tells the truth to people, like, to sleep, and it's like, it's a really cliche thing to say I sleep well at night, but to get a night's sleep where I don't go to bed worried about what is going to greet me the next morning, or to get a night's sleep where I'm not worried about, like, if someone is going to find out that I've lied to them about something, is incredible.
Wow. So you're living this waking nightmare, and it's requiring more and more drastic measures to keep it going. But, like, how bad did it get? I guess what I'm wondering is, like, literally, how much of other people's money did you end up spending, Casey?
The total amount that I ended up taking from people is around $500,000 from everything combined.
And how long did it take you to spend $500,000?
2 years.
Wow. Wait a second. 2 years. If you went to Germany in 2009, that brings us up to 2011. And isn't that around the same time the West Memphis Three got out of prison?
So they were released from prison in August of 2011. In September of 2011, my band played a show with the band UMI at a place called the Sunset Tavern in Seattle, a little rock club. And Jason Baldwin was a couple weeks released from prison. And Danny Bland, who I was living with in Seattle and who had orchestrated the first West Memphis 3 benefit and who I had worked with on this second one, brought Jason to the show. So the first live music Jason Baldwin ever saw in a bar was my band, the Sunset Tavern. And I was looking at him and talking to him and knowing in the back of my head the entire time that I had stolen hundreds of thousands of dollars essentially in his name.
Oh, Casey.
And it was just like I was overwhelmed and felt so disgusted with myself and overwhelmed by guilt and just physically sick.
Hey friends, I just wanted to thank you for listening and to let you know that if you want to support the podcast even more, you can head over to iTunes where you can rate it and even more importantly, where you can write a review. It's really the best way to help make sure other people find out about The Confessional. And if you'd like to hear and read more from me, you can sign up for my free newsletter and receive regular essays and prayers and, let's be honest, a whole lot of opinions over at nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's nadiaboltzweber.substack.com. That's my little corner of the internet called, appropriately enough, The Corners. See you there. Thanks so much. So, Casey, how'd you get caught in the end?
I'm going to put us now in like the summer of 2012. So I am still having really extreme manic episodes that last for months. Like, I was using and drinking to the extent that it was not very possible for me to hide it from everyone. I was around all the time. I was around my bandmates, and we were pretty busy with shows and working on records. So we go on tour with Counting Crows. My band at the time was called Casey Anderson and the Honkies. That tour wrapped up in September, and I came home. I was living at the time with Danny Bland, who was the person I originally contacted about the West Memphis 3 benefit, and got a message from him that said, I think that we need to talk. And so I go to the house, and he just said, first of all, I want you to know that I know that you're not sober, and you haven't been for a while, and I don't know why you haven't talked to me about that. And secondly, I have been contacted by the FBI and they're aware of what you did financially because someone who you defrauded has reported you to them. So this is going to end up being a significant amount of trouble for you in your life going forward. And he was like as kind and diplomatic. I could not believe it. He should have been like, I would have been just beating the shit out of me. Probably. Mm. And the West Memphis 3, he had become very, very close with Damien and Jason and Jesse over the course of working for more than a decade on trying to help them with their release. And so it wasn't just like, I can't believe that you committed this crime. I can't believe that you stole money from people. It looked like it was so much deeper than that. And I had known Danny by that time for, over 10 years. And so there are all these layers of like, I can't believe that this is what our friendship was to you. I can't believe that you used these people's cause, this cause that I care so much about, this cause that you told me you care about. I remember him just saying like, I can't believe, I can't understand. I truly can't understand how you did that.
So what was going on in your brain and in your body?
I was like weeping. I was weeping really openly and I was saying, I can't explain it. I don't know either. I can't explain it. I don't know why I did this. I don't know why I kept doing it. I was so far past the point of, like, I was not at that time probably deserving of empathy from anyone. Like, I had gone so far past the point of no return that anything I would have said would have sounded so hollow. And I hadn't told anyone the truth about anything for years. So it wouldn't have, whatever I said at that time would have been construed as a lie, whether it was the truth or not.
Who in the world do you turn to after a conversation like that?
So there was a psychiatrist that I had seen as a teenager. I had some behavioral issues as a teenager. I had, my substance use started very early on in my life. And so I went back to seeing him. And the first thing he said, we did another sort of intake reevaluation. And he said, this does seem like type 1 bipolar disorder, but I can't treat you if you're going to continue using and drinking. You're not going to be able to parse your symptoms of mania or depression with your use of stimulants and depressants.
Right, of course, yeah.
So I went to an intensive outpatient rehab. I went through that. I stopped using cocaine and alcohol. That was October 23rd, 2012. That's my, you know, what people say is their sobriety date or my recovery date. And I finally went into prison in December of 2013. And I remember walking in the first night and just thinking like, oh, holy shit, it's really, like, this is real prison. The officers in charge of the unit were not especially pleasant or respectful. The other inmates, like, were not especially welcoming to me. It was prison. It was prison. It was a place where people go to be punished.
I do have a question about the time that you served. Is that mm-hmm. what in the experience of being inside for 2 years changed you?
Well, it was involuntary, but I had to sit with myself. Hmm. You know what I mean? I just am sitting in a room with myself and my past and trying to reckon with it. And I would not recommend prison as a vehicle for someone to go through that process. But for me, it was probably the only way that it would have happened.
No, I get it.
And I think part of that is the mania and depression and the mental health component. And I think part of it is just being so, like, once I was in that cycle, there were so many fires to put out every day that I was exhausted by the end of the day and I didn't have the energy to do any sort of observing ego work.
What did you see when you spent that 2 years in a room by yourself, sort of forced to do your personal work? What did you discover?
Like, I went into prison thinking I'm a horrible person. I'm a piece of shit. Like, only a horrible person would do these things to people. Only an irredeemable person could do these things to people. And I started through the work that I did and through looking back at my life and trying to contextualize a few years of my life within the greater scope of my life. Like, I did horrible things. That doesn't mean that I was a horrible person.
I want to hear you talk about blame. Like, there were things that factored into what you did that weren't a matter of choice, right? So having bipolar one, that's not a choice. So it's always interesting, where do we place blame when there are factors you didn't choose that are playing into it? Because it's hard in people's lives when we have people who have hurt us, who have caused us harm, to know where do we have compassion for them and where do we sort of hold them accountable? And how do you see that whole mess of things?
First of all, I think there's a difference between a reason and an excuse, right? To me, it's appropriate for me to say, hey, like, I have this mental health disorder. I have a substance use disorder. Those are partially reasons I did the things I did.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't understand that, then that's fine. That's not, you know, it's not their responsibility to offer me sympathy for that. But it's also, it would be disingenuous of me to pretend that those parts of my life and of my brain didn't exist.
Yeah. Factors not of your choosing.
Factors not of my choosing. But I also think that I try and think about it from the perspective of, okay, if someone did that to me, you know, if I am not at a place where I can loan someone $30,000 right now, but if someone came to me and said, I have this opportunity to contribute to a charitable cause, can you give me $500, right? Whatever I can spare. And I did it, and they never paid me back. And then they said, well, you have to understand, like, I have bipolar 1 disorder and I have substance use disorder. That doesn't give me my money back. So it doesn't help me really to know that about you, other than, you know, it gives me an opportunity to show some empathy. Mm-hmm. It would be extremely selfish and arrogant of me to expect forgiveness from people because you can't go back and right those wrongs.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they see the way that I move through the world now, then they recognize that there's a change. And if they don't, then that's okay too. I mean, that's their...
They don't owe it to you.
They don't owe it to me.
Yeah.
And also, I pay restitution every month.
Who does it go to?
That's a great question. At the beginning of my probation, I played a show where I made a decent amount of money. And so I came into my probation officer's office one day after playing the show and said, hey, I'm going to make like a pretty big restitution payment. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. And he said, why? I said, well, like, it's the right thing to do. I have this extra money. I have my monthly budget that I live on. I don't need this extra money right now. And I hurt these people and I want to make sure that they're getting their money back. And he said, well, you can do that. And that's admirable that you want to do that. And I encourage you to make as big a restitution payment as you can, because this is a debt that you owe. But I want you to know that that money is collected by the United States government. It is not paid out to your victims. So
what? Wait.
Yeah.
Hold on. What?
I mean, that's like in a civil case, the money would go to the victims. In a federal criminal case, the restitution money is collected by the federal government.
That feels super fucked up.
It doesn't seem right to me either.
Oh, that's crazy.
So in terms of blame, there were spots along the way where I could have asked somebody for help, but I didn't take those opportunities. So the blame rests on me, but I can also acknowledge, A, that those choices were informed by co-occurring disorders, and B, that my life is very different today than it was then. You know, and I can be proud of the changes I've made without ignoring the things that led to those changes.
You know, personal accountability in terms of the choices we make and the harm that those choices make is important. And these other factors that were involved in creating this situation are also important. I mean, I think one of the things that comes up in this show a lot is having to hold paradox a little bit, having to hold two things. More than one thing can be true at a time.
Yeah. If you move through your life and say, well, none of this is my fault because all of this happened to me, then you're centering yourself and you're the most important thing in the world because all of this is visited upon you by some other force. And on the other side of that paradox is there were no other deciding factors other than just like, I am this horrible, disgusting, irredeemable human being. And once again, like, that centers you in the narrative and makes you the most important thing in the universe because you're moving through the world creating all of this havoc. And if I hold on to the belief that, yeah, there's a God, but it's not me, then I'm not either of those things. I'm not so important that I can derail the entire universe. And I'm not so important that the entire universe is geared to derail my specific life.
Yeah, we're all a combination of volunteer and victim. But Casey, I guess just from talking to you, I have to say, it sounds like you've really come to a better place after all of this. And before we go, I'd just love to hear you say a little more about what your life looks like now. And like specifically, what do your relationships with other people look like now?
I feel like a lot of my relationships prior to going to prison were relationships of convenience and sort of moving through circles who hadn't yet seen through my bullshit. And my relationship with my mom and, you know, my dad before he passed and now my brother, my relationship with my family is now based in honesty. And that's not something that I had practiced with my family. And I think that it's something that's a hard thing for a family to practice when it's a family of four people and one of those people is in a constant state of chaos. It's really hard for anyone else to get the emotional or psychological attention that they need. And so I think that a lot of people's needs got neglected in my family just because everybody's emotional resources were devoted to trying to get me from one day to the next.
And then just quickly, you're not really in the music business quite so much anymore, but tell me what work you do.
I still make records very slowly. My job is I work at a recovery services nonprofit, the Alano Club of Portland, here in Portland, as a program coordinator. So I get to come up with ways that people in recovery can try and integrate things like writing or making art or cooking and try and make it, you know, a little more accessible to people who may not have experience with those things.
Mm. Amazing. Well, I'm so grateful that you came on.
I'm grateful to be on. This was great.
It's incredible story. And I just wish you well. And I think that one of the things that I've sort of taken away from this is that idea of having a compassionate view of what is really something that's in my control and what are some things that aren't in my control and how can I hold the truth of both of those as I sort of look at my life. And I think that's really helpful.
I think we're all at a place right now where we're having to really reckon with things that are completely out of our control.
No kidding. All right. Well, thank you so much, Casey. I'm so grateful.
Thanks, Nadia. It was really nice talking to you.
a blessing for Casey. Casey, when you came into the confessional to tell me what landed you in prison, I had no idea it was going to involve the West Memphis Three, specifically Damian Echols and his wife, Lori Davis. And I'm pretty sure you didn't know that I actually have a connection with those two. And so when it came time for me to write a blessing for you, I wondered if maybe they had something they would offer, a word, a blessing, a gift. And they do, Casey, and they sent it to me. So here's what Damian Echols and Lori Davis asked me to read to you as a blessing, which starts with this verse. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to God's purpose. So, whatever happened back then, for whatever reason, it serves us. We forgive you, Casey. Far worse things were done. We forgive everyone and ask forgiveness for the wrong we've done. In the end, Damian, Jesse, and Jason were freed, and that's all that matters. There you go, friend. I just can't think of a better blessing than unexpected forgiveness. May you accept it as the gift it is and offer it to yourself and to others as often as humanly possible. Amen. Next time on The Confessional.
But like being a father, I have to excel at that because a lot of people felt like were expecting me not to.
The Confessional is produced by House of Pod and Shameless Media, with support and spiritual guidance from The Moth and PRX. Our original music is composed by Antoine Banks Williams. From PRX.